Welcome to Shanghai Zhan, a raw and lively regular debate about China tech, advertising, creativity, platforms, and the intersection of it all. Join us each session for timely and relevant discussions about all things China marketing. We'll also be joined by an entire spectrum of China experts. You can learn more about Shanghai Zhan at our website, zhanstation.com. I'm Bryce Witwam.
And I'm Ali Kazmi.
And Ali, we're always looking for that continued support, and we know how that works in the world of algorithms, that if you like the show, you can, of course, share it with your friends, but better yet, give us that five-star review. Go on Apple Podcasts, go on Spotify, go on Xiaoyuzhou, and just give us one of those great reviews. The more reviews we get, the more viewers we get. It's simple as that. Just make that happen. We really appreciate it. And today, we are doing a follow-up podcast from our live stream that we did a couple weeks ago. We're doing a follow-up with that. If you didn't catch the live podcast, we will put the link in the show notes. But we thought that we would sit down again and go through each of the five considerations. So if you haven't watched the live podcast, we encourage you to do so. No need. This podcast is designed separately, that we will literally go through each of the five trends that are in the China Trend episode. And we'll go through them each one of them and discuss it. So today, we're thrilled again to have Chris Baker. He's the founder of Totem. He's been doing the report for about 9 years now, which is called, the topic is the 10 considerations of marketing for China in 2024. And also we're joined by Minnie Wong, a senior reporter of Campaign Asia, who are sponsors of today's show. Minnie, Chris, welcome to Shanghai Zhan.
Hi, everyone.
So Chris, we'll just turn it over to you. I guess the first question is, you've been doing this for 9 years. You mentioned previously that it's a passion project. It's quite a passion. How much effort do you go into this? Who do you interview? What's the process? Could you just give us a quick intro to your report?
Sure. Yeah, fairly involved process. And year by year, we kind of try to make sure that every year after the next is slightly better than the previous year. So, you know, what started as a very kind of simple and easy report where we kind of highlighted a few of the growing trends that we were observing with both partners and clients in China has become a project that takes us about 3 months to pull together overall. And it starts with a brand survey that we've been doing now for 9 years, where we send out a set of questions to senior marketers across a range of brands who are operating and building brands in China, with the idea being that we're trying to answer key questions around how are they spending their money and investments into marketing, what priorities do they have for their brand, and what's their overall sentiment towards the market, as well as getting into some of the tactical details around what channels are capturing their attention and are paying off for them year over year. So that's high-level view of the brand survey side of things. We also supplement that with interviews of both brands as well as specialist agencies and other participants in the market to really round out and get a feel for what's happening overall.
And you can download the entire report, right? You can, it's free to download. We can provide a link in the show notes to that. That's correct, right? You can download the report.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, as you say, it'll be on your show notes and at our website, which is talktototem.com.
Okay, great. So let's just get right down to it. Let's start with consideration number one, which I think is probably something that's easily been discussed many times in the media and seen in other trends, but of course it's a big one considering the economic transformation that's taking place in China, which is of course is that value above everywhere else. Maybe Chris, you could just talk a little bit about it and then we'll discuss it.
Yeah, so I think that's probably trend number two, but let's start with value. So I think one of the things we've been doing throughout many years of this report is really trying to understand across different types of brands, how are they faring in the overall marketplace? And I think one of the distinctions that we make is that there are different types of brands, you know, luxury and leader brands on one end of the spectrum, you know, discount brands on the other end of the spectrum. And in between are, you know, brands that offer strong value. And, you know, what we found is a really significant shift in interest towards value brands in the past year. And that's should come as no surprise given kind of economic challenges in the market. You know, there has been a pretty significant slowdown, and customers are just being very prudent and cautious. And so, you know, we've kind of seen, you know, a shift from maybe brand selection that was a little bit less focused in the past to you know, really focusing in and around making sure that if I only have a few RMB to spend on any one thing, I'm going to make sure it counts, right? So value is the name of the game in this market.
So I guess my question would be, who's impacted by that? How, let's just take luxury brands for starters. How does a luxury brand adjust their marketing strategy to this trend? Are they impacted by sales? Because certainly, yes, you mentioned in the report that people still will buy a luxury product from once in a while. But certainly the volume cannot be as it once was. Is there a push to talk more about quality of product? If you mentioned the fact that if people are not going to buy as much, maybe they'll buy something that lasts longer. Or that's not the case.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think in the luxury space is unique in China in that, you know, I think there's a core group of buyers who are stable, repeat luxury buyers, and that's largely unchanged even in a down market. I think in the luxury space what we've observed is that sort of the long tail of buyers who in headier times were coming into the luxury space and being occasional buyers are now shifting away from semi-regular purchases of luxury and shifting more towards value brands and products to make sure that, you know, they're cautious around their spending, right? So I think that's important. The other thing that we really took note of was that, you know, in kind of headier times, there was a lot of focus in terms of marketing around building hype, where now we're kind of seeing a little bit of a shift more towards how brands construct social proof and give people confidence around purchase, knowing that, you know, somebody may not buy as often or maybe much more cautious. And so, you know, brands just need to really demonstrate that value to their customers. Luxury is immune in a sense, right? To a large extent, right? I think that in this space, the question of value is really being played out amongst sort of that next cut of brands that include, you know, what we like to call aspirant brands, brands that are kind of just struggling to make a dent in the market. You know, for them, what we're seeing is that some of the marketing campaigns that would have really been dedicated towards building hype and perhaps doing live streaming even are kind of shifting a little bit more towards things like private traffic. I know in the recap podcast you guys did, there's this notion that private traffic would be totally dedicated towards loyalty. But what we've actually found is that brands are shifting and applying private traffic for acquisition as well, right? So, you know, with the idea being that you can kind of construct social proof through a community, and it's a sane way of doing it instead of just using an influencer to shill products.
Interesting. Let's move to the second one, which was actually the first one. Apologize, I've gone out of order here, which is, I guess, is probably related to the first one, which is about value. and that is divides are growing. Do you want to give us a quick intro, Chris?
Yeah, briefly, I think this one is really, you know, we're pointing out the fact that I think for the last 10, let's say even 20 years, right, you know, the middle class in China has just been growing incredibly consistently across all city tiers. And while that continues to take place, you know, there is a little bit of a divide growing where the middle class is, you know, that expansion is starting to slow down, right? And what we're witnessing is that, you know, there really is a divide between wealthier and older customers versus younger and less established customers on the other end. So, you know, you think about a marketplace that's looking a little bit more like an hourglass with, you know, the haves at the top and you know, the have-nots, so to speak, at the other end of the hourglass, right? So, that's something that we're seeing kind of play out here in pretty significant terms, right? I mean, one of the stats I thought was absolutely shocking was from Farfetch, where, you know, top 1% of their customer base now accounts for 27% of purchases, right? You know, in the luxury space. And, you know, it's a heavy load being lifted by that top-end consumer.
It certainly came out in full force last week with the store opening and the Apple store opening in Jing'an. I know we often don't consider Apple a luxury brand, but I mean, anybody that can afford an Apple phone is got to be in the top tier, right? There's still the hype. Part of it is driving that, you know, as a result of the divide, but certainly the hype will definitely play into that. So I guess from that aspect, is the middle class changing? Are they evolving from what they used to be in terms of their shopping behavior? I guess maybe that connects more with the idea of becoming more value-oriented. You mentioned also in the report that these two trends, both divides and value, are impacting how people shop and the decline of shopping festivals that we've seen. Double 11 not doing as well as it used to. Part of people say is that, yeah, brands are looking at different ways to connect with consumers 365 days a year, not necessarily just focusing on the 6 brand festivals that happen around the calendar.
Yeah, no, 2 additional insights around that. I think, as you pointed out, one is, yeah, we're really seeing this kind of slowdown in shopping festivals. I think one is, I think there's a little bit of people getting worn out with so many shopping festivals, and they've been going for years. That's one. But, you know, a lot of it has to do with that shift towards less festival pricing and more everyday low prices. I think that's one. And two was, you know, we really observe that with this kind of divide growing, that, you know, it's not going to take place overnight. You know, the middle class in China is not going to wither and die, you know, in a year or two. It's just that, you know, that kind of incredible push to drive into lower tier cities that brands have been making for the last several years, well, you know, some of that effort might be well placed to focus a little bit more on, you know, targeting generational strata of customers, for instance, right? So we thought that was a really important insight or strategy that brands should consider, especially if, you know, they're brands that have kind of been trying to really play into that emerging middle class. I think the emerging middle class is under some duress. I think the established middle class and upper classes are in pretty good shape still.
I definitely agree with you on that. When I was back doing car brands, I was sent to Japan to help on a BMW pitch, particularly on Mini. And in Japan, unlike China, that Mini had 2 customer segments. They had the younger segment, which was, you know, the people just, you know, that could afford a Mini in their mid-20s. And then they had the elderly segment. There's this older group that was just kind of trying to relive their youth. and they were also interested in the brand. And I think now in China that we may have some of those people that may come into certain target segments in their elder years, where before, at least back, let's say 10 years ago in China, those people would never desire to have these kind of products. But nowadays, as they've become so ubiquitous in the marketplace, to as they get older and maybe have some disposable income from their retirement or from other places, they're able to afford those things.
Yes, I was about to ask the same question. It's called the silver economy in China now. And I just read yesterday, and they said that the real new middle class now are people in their late 50s or even 60s. They are the new middle class. And I also read a very interesting phenomenon in the Totems report is that the so-called Gen Z problem, because they have probably a very high youth unemployment rates now. And so the report still thinks Gen X and Gen Y will remain core drivers of the consumption. So I have a question for you, Chris. What is your perspective on the Gen Z's changing approach to consumerism in China, as they're now becoming more cautious? And so what are the potential factors that might affect their consumption habits in the near future?
Yeah, no, great question, Mini. I think we're monitoring that really closely, right? Because I think we see Gen Z being the least kind of monolithic or singular in their approach, right? And so in one sense, we see some Gen Z flourishing and doing well, many of whom have real stability within the family, and they can purchase what they want, when they want, and there's not many constraints. Where, you know, the other segment of Gen Z are laying flat and kind of being slightly countercultural. But I think decisions around products within that generation are way more fragmented than any of the previous generations. So for me, I think that's the single biggest insight about Gen Z.
I think it's really interesting that Ali and I had member Gary and Mark from Estee Lauder, and we asked them, who are based in New York, and we asked them regarding their global jobs, what was the biggest difference between the beauty category in China and the one globally? And they said, in China, you just knock off 10 years. Or in this case, you add 10 years for everything when you go outside of China. I think in some aspects, maybe China is becoming more like the rest of the world, and that Gen Z in China are no longer able to be the core target for Le Maire and McLaren, you know, that it's becoming more realistic that's actually you have to get a little bit older in life to be able to afford such products.
No, absolutely. I mean, we have that discussion all the time with clients who are based in Europe or the US, as you say, Bryce. I mean, yeah, adjust whatever you're doing as a core audience group in Europe or the US, dial it down by 10 years. In terms of, you know, the behavior and mindset of a Gen Z in China, yeah, they're probably more likely to be similar to their counterparts in the US, let's say, than they are similar to Gen X in China, right? In terms of their mindset. So I think it's really... that's really important.
Should we just move down the list? Consideration number three is called trust under pressure. What do you mean by trust under pressure, Chris?
So, yeah, this one was interesting. You know, a lot of the insights for these came up in discussion with other data science people or specialist agencies. And we tried to kind of bring a few things together here with this. And I think it all fits under the notion that, you know, as customers become more value conscious and careful with their spending, right, like the stakes are raised for that relationship between a brand and a customer. In this instance, there's a sense of, on one hand, you know, brands need to really be on point in terms of managing customer PR, right? This past year, there were some really notable PR gaffes by people like Canada Goose and Floresis, who, you know, were otherwise real darlings of customers in China. Small problems get amplified in a higher pressure environment where people need to get more out of their spending. So I think that's the core of this. But we've also seen challenges for brand marketers in terms of customers returning products more often. Return rates are way up, and you know, there's a flood of gray market entrants of products that are being offered up at a lower price. So from a brand marketing point of view, it's really just the stakes are raised, and it's becoming an even more high pressure environment given the economic situation.
So given that, what do you think brands should do? How should they adjust to this? Prior to this, I always felt that trust was always under pressure in China, that we were scrutinized at such a high level in social media. What do you think brands should do that they aren't doing now?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, most of the top performing brands are operating at a really high level already in the market, right? And some of these things come out of left field and are hard to protect against. You know, some PR crises, simple kind of slips of a very subtle thing that grow into a bigger problem. But, you know, two things, I think probably monitoring a little bit more closely, right? Like those small early signals that something might spiral out of control. You know, but and on the other side, if brands don't already have, you know, really strong, you know, post-purchase engagement programs, I think there's probably a call to make sure that the people who are your core customers, you've really got them locked down and on side with you, so that if something explodes, they've got your back.
I think this also relates to, and we're going to get into this a little bit more, and this was an article that many posted on Campaign Asia about the changes in social media. Is this also required? If trust is under pressure, what are the channels? What are the brand marketers telling you that they're doing related to media spend, related to improving or at least trying to face this challenge head on?
You know, I'm not so sure that in terms of media spend that brands are really addressing these problems yet head on. But I think that what we do see is sort of those early signs that brands are, you know, trying to construct social proof and rally customer groups to their side on a consistent basis, where maybe for the last 5 years it was more about kind of just building hype all the time, right? So yeah, it's consistent thing, right? And it's a subtle change. So that's one of the reasons I think when, you know, we looked at some of the tactics that brands are using, there's a little bit of a shift maybe taking place from, you know, live streaming and the hype kind of that comes with that to something like private traffic, where you can really cultivate an audience and get new purchasers from that trusted community.
I mean, I can try to answer that question, but before I do, Mini, do you want to share your point of view on how you can build trust for brands in China, and then I'm happy to offer an agency/strategist perspective as well.
Yeah, I think I can only share my observation, because Chris mentioned that the key part is the post-purchase interaction. So it came to my mind a very successful brand. It's called Jellycat, a plush brand from UK. And like 7 years ago when I was in UK, I just bought these toys. But I think back then no one in China even know the name. But now they have a Chinese name, Jili Mao, and they're so successful everywhere on Chinese social media. When you open Red, when you open this, and you will see the posts, it's from user-generated content. It looks like UGC content. I don't know if it's the brand strategy to interact with their audience intentionally, or it's just the audience, they just upload their video or their posts onto Red and social media. But they're successful, they're everywhere. So it's so hard to buy even a few products, and that's why they kind of built trust between the audience and the brands. And now it's like a great phenomenon in China. So it's like you choose the right social media channel, and with deeper and omnichannel interactions, especially on the right social media channel, and then you will be successful in China. So I think it's partly because social media is a quite key channel to build this kind of trust. And I believe that maybe RAD is one of the best platform, but it's just like an observation from my audience. I'm not from a brand perspective or any professional perspective.
Yeah, just to build on that, Minnie, I think one of the things in terms of the specific use of RED that, you know, we employ with our clients is that we use RED early in the development of a brand to build share of voice, because it's that channel that more than any other one currently is the one that people use as a reference to say, oh, is this brand good? Does it have kind of that positive feeling, and are people buying it? So it's sort of the proof point that helps, you know, somebody really say, oh yeah, I feel comfortable with this, right? So building share of voice inside of RED is that kind of critical lever to get things rolling from a brand point of view. And I think in a market like this where you need to kind of support with social proof, I mean, share of voice is critical.
Yeah, agreed. And also it's RED is so powerful in de-influencing. I mean, last year, I remember the first time Cathay Pacific's so-called carpet airline crisis just broke out on RED. It's the ad RED users that she sent a post, and then everyone goes to that post. And then we began to see a brand crisis back then. So I think it's becoming a really powerful tool for brand PR probably in the future.
So some of the things that were going through my mind really as we talked about, as we talk about trust and brand trust or product trust, I mean, if I were to break down what trust means, you know, it's things like, will the product last? Is it worth, you know, the price that you're paying for that product? Will it be as effective as, you know, whatever it was that I purchased before? So if you're replacing an iPhone with an iPhone, or a, you know, a Xiaomi with an Apple, for example, all of these types of cues help build that trust. You know, is it as good as what I was recommended? So there's an expectation. And then of course the ultimate, I think, is going to be if I'm willing to recommend it to someone else. And I wouldn't be willing to recommend Minnie or anyone on this on the live cast or on the show a product that, you know, that I kind of didn't trust. But, you know, in that, I think there's this thought where, you know, efficacy trumps brand recognition. So here the play is really on whether the product does what it claims to do. And if it does, if it meets or exceeds that expectation, then you're just more likely to share that with someone else. I guess the opportunity then is that, you know, it opens up this playground for OEM brands or alternatives to some of the most recognized brands to introduce product into market at a much more competitive price point. So on the one hand, you've got, you know, there's this expectation that you want to meet. And that's kind of like the foundation of what we'll call trust in this case. And then there is how, as a marketer, as the owner of that product, you want to ride on how consumers see your product. And so I think that example that Minnie shared, you know, it kind of resonated with me, where it's, you know, it's marketing with consumers and not at consumers. So it's, you know, it's building a product that has, that offers a very specific benefit, and that benefit is designed around consumer needs, and that's expressed in their USPs and their communications, and that communication is led through social media, and, you know, there's rewards that are designed around consumers, or, you know, people that are able to talk about that product within social channels. So I think, I mean, net for me, you know, if trust seems to have, you know, is outweighing some of these other values, then it seems, you know, one, that it's an opportunity for new entrants into product that have higher quality, that are able to connect with consumers, that are able to design communication programs that really cut through and kind of build or create their own niche in market. So that's how I kind of see this question on how to build trusted brands.
Yeah, at the end of the day, there's no hiding from a bad product either, right? And I think, I think back to, there's a lot of brands that we work with or have monitored, who have great programs where, once you purchase something, there's an incentive there specifically to share on Red, right? For instance, right? There's the incentive, but the product also has to be good. Otherwise, the net effect of that just doesn't land well for the brand, right? So what you don't want to be doing as a brand, is, if you've got a bad product, is incentivizing sharing at that moment a truth and have it land in a bad way and say, oh, I hated this product. And then you get into a problem where you're just building negative sentiment right off the gate, right? So alignment of expectations, as you said, Ali, with reality is critical in this market.
And I think it's maybe that if you look at trust as between two variables of trust in the influencer, like that connection, that trust of the influencer, and then trust in the product, maybe we're seeing the pendulum swing very much to trust in the product and less about trust in the influencer. And that also impacts maybe because you mentioned, and this is the other, we've talked about this quite a lot, about the changes in social commerce. Ali and I mentioned that, a few weeks ago on our recap, which is really about seeing platforms like Pinduoduo, Xiaohongshu. We mentioned Red a lot on the show, and Douyin are all rapidly increasing. Taobao, Tmall. I don't know. You mentioned Jingdong in your report. They're on the decline. Do you think that maybe it was because is it the technology that's related to that? Is it mainly that people, or is it in terms of the ability to be able to get information more effectively from other platforms? Is it a technology play in the context of social media that these platforms are more social? Or is it that Alibaba was relying a lot on big play kind of live stream influencers like Austin Lee types to promote products? Where do you see the gap has occurred in the Alibaba sense, and why is it being picked up in these other platforms?
Yeah, so I think just to be clear, first of all, Tmall, JD, those big established platforms, they still represent, when it comes to pure e-commerce, the bulk of the market, right? So when we look at the growth of Pinduoduo, Douyin, Red, it really represents them coming from a much smaller base and being the place where those big incremental gains are coming from, right, for brands. So when we ask the question to brands, we've asked similar questions in about four different ways to understand, where are they seeing gains coming from, their previous year's investment, how did that track? Yeah, and consistently over probably the last 4 years, Red and Douyin have been called out as the two growth channels that, they're seeing a bump. So and that's reflected as well in data that we got from Mujing, who's a big e-commerce data provider, where things like Pinduoduo up 93% year over year in terms of traffic, Douyin up 139%. Again, there's coming from slightly smaller bases, but those are significant numbers when Tmall is flat. And to kind of finally get around to answering your question, Bryce, I think the gains from those what we call social commerce platforms, I think they probably come from two different places. I think in the case of Pinduoduo, it comes from value seeking and the fact that, there's that group sales function of driving down lower discounts or bigger discounts to get a lower price. Where I think in the case of Douyin and Red, I think there's more novelty and fun taking place there, right? You know, like once you subtract Austin Lee and some of the big influencers out of Tmall, well, the fun is not quite there anymore, right? And I think the fun has shifted over, right, for that type of purchaser into Red and Douyin.
Yeah, before we start to record this show, earlier this week I found that even Art Basel Hong Kong, it's going to open this week, and they began their official cooperation with Red as one of the fastest growing channels. But like Chris mentioned, Tmall and JD are still the major e-commerce platforms in China. Like, I'm quite an old-fashioned consumer, so I actually mostly want to buy products from Tmall and JD, but I won't choose Douyin. So I'm also curious to know, under the current reliance on the social media and these algorithms, and it signifies probably a transformation in e-commerce, does that mean the big data could be manipulated probably by brands or even MarTech platforms to persuade me to make some more purchase decisions because of these, you know, this lower price, or because of what you're in your report you call the Red and Douyin from excitement to e-commerce model? I'm so really happy to see this live stream, and I will buy some product that is not really that a reasonable decision. Would you worry about that? If you are a user of Douyin or Red, you will buy too much.
I wouldn't worry that I would buy too much. I'm a very frugal shopper, but yeah, I think what I worry about is my kids on those platforms, right? And I think, you know, younger generation of shopper is what we've seen repeatedly over the last several years is this idea of see now, buy now when it comes to, you know, purchasing, particularly on Douyin, right? And we've given a lot of love to Red in the discussion today, but Douyin is equally, if not more potent, you know, than Red, right? For that ability to kind of convert hype to execution in terms of a sale, right? And reflecting on this kind of movement towards social commerce a little bit further, you know, one of the issues around Gen Z and social commerce is that while I might be a very pragmatic consumer and I'm more transactional and I do my search and research and then I purchase at a place that I know, like Tmall, I think for Gen Z, there's more of an idea of them following a social thread and being part of a community and demonstrating cred through purchase and being more spontaneous. And if your brain is basically been, you know, sapped of its energy from watching, you know, endless scroll of, you know, cat videos and people dancing, well, yeah, you might be subject to some real bad decision making.
I think that plays into the whole social commerce mix, that there's a high sense of wanting to demonstrate your purchase after you made it, that there's the need to create that social content to, as you mentioned, improve social proof, to demonstrate to your friends that you made the right decision. Now's the time to show it off. And that was basically the fourth consideration, which was the social commerce part, and about social commerce rips, which is the title of that one, which we talked quite at length about the move into social commerce, the move more towards social commerce. The 90 marketers that you talked to said that there's a greater emphasis on that, specifically targeting and marketing through these channels, not necessarily to take away from the volume business that exists on the other e-commerce plays. The final consideration of the five, now there's 10 considerations, we're just focusing on five, and for the remaining five considerations, as we mentioned, people can download the report. But you mentioned that the last one is about impact versus impressions. Could you explain that, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think, you know, this is a sign of the times, right? If consumers are concerned about value, so too are the brands and management teams that fund marketing programs, right? And so, you know, both through the survey as well as work that we've done, you know, with brand leaders in terms of budgeting. I mean, you know, there's a call for higher touch, more involvement, more demonstration of results in marketing, right? This year than historically there might have been. You know, marketing teams in China are always very pragmatic around KPIs that hit pretty close to sales. You know, we're really seeing kind of this idea that marketing budgets need to really do the heavy lifting of both building awareness as well as you know, landing customers and driving sales right now more than ever. So some of the discussions we had with brand leaders were that, hey, we're not going to do three big campaigns in 2024. We may only do one really big campaign, and that campaign has to deliver both on brand as well as sales results, right? So there's really this idea that from a marketing point of view, again, quality and value and impact are prioritized.
So I noticed in the report that you also, this is later on in the report, you asked them about spending priorities and what was the most important, and sales came out number one. But like you said, like brand image and brand awareness, those things also were close second and thirds. With that in mind, is can you effectively create brand image and sales by doing fewer campaigns? Is that what you're getting the sense of? I mean, to me, in some aspects, it's kind of a contradiction. If you're going to focus on brand and build brand for the long term, but at the same time, you're putting all your money in short-term sales. How does the brand effectively balance the two? And maybe Minnie and Ali have a thought on that as well.
Well, yeah, just I'll briefly clarify. I think my interpretation of some of the results there from the survey were that, you know, we had a cohort of brands that are suffering slightly under the weight of expectations to create sales. And so for them, I mean, sales is the number one priority, and getting marketing that aligns as closely to that as possible is key. You know, there's another group out there that recognizes that their brand is not weak enough to do a lot of the work in bringing that along, right? And so for them, there's this idea that, well, yeah, we want to generate the sales, but actually, you know, we're really, there's a missing piece here, which is a strong brand. Right. So that would be my interpretation of that.
So I'm going to rephrase the question just for myself so I can answer it in a slightly different way, or maybe in a way that complements some of the things that have been shared. But I was thinking around, you know, how to build brands on with low budgets as this conversation was ongoing. And some of the things that just kind of resonate with me is just startup thinking and startup mentality. And when you look at startup companies and you think about how they, you know, build brands with, you know, with on a shoestring kind of budget, they look at, you know, their first 100, their first 1,000, or their first 100,000 users, and they set goalposts in a way where, you know, it's not about achieving X awareness, or, you know, being exposed to, you know, 10 million people, or getting that frequency, you know, capped at whatever 6 or 7 hits over a calendar week. So, you know, they're the way they build that core consumer base is very different to the way traditional marketers think about, you know, capturing as much consumer as possible. I think there's a lot to learn within the startup kind of narrative of how businesses are built. And if, you know, if we could kind of steal some of that language, some of that KPI setting, then, you know, that can be beneficial to brands that are looking at accelerating growth within this type of an economic climate. So if you're, you know, whether it's a CPG product, you know, how do you get your first 1,000 consumers in a very specific, you know, in Beijing, and that's all you're focused on, right? And how do you get them to advocate your product, and how do you get them to endorse your product within a social setting? on Xiaohongshu, on Red for that matter. How do you get moms within households in, I don't know, in the Dongzhimen area? Because that's where, you know, that's where a concentration of your product is being sold. How do you get them to kind of advocate within their households, within their communities? And I think that type of thinking is very aligned with the way startups operate and the way they work and think versus how larger brands that are looking at scale from the get-go would think, right? So for example, you know, within a Unilever or a Coca-Cola or a P&G, I'm sure that they kill more brands than they launch year on year. Or rather, they have new product development kind of business units, and those business units are just focused entirely on launching new brands. And it's not that the product that they launch is drastically different to the one that they had before. But the, you know, the manner and the mechanics that they use to launch that brand, the expectation is that they're going to hit 10 million customers right off the bat. And they're great products, right? Every product that they launch is a great product and there's a market out there for them. But I think that mindset of how do you get to, you know, a core customer base and how do you use sentiment and feedback and improve that product and continue to grow your both that customer base, but also your influence base. I think that type of mentality needs to sink into advertisers in this economic climate.
Yeah, Ali, just to add to that slightly, I think bigger brands run into the challenge of trying to do a little bit of everything for everyone because they've got just too many different customers spread out over such a range. And as you say, you know, if they can apply startup thinking and say, you know what, no, there's really just one customer that really matters to us. And let's do something brave and memorable with that one person, you know, in this context. And then that's where the gains come, I think.
That's where you learn something as well, right? So if you don't know who your core customer is, then you're going to mean too many things to too many different people. And that's going to mess up your messaging. It's going to mess up your internal communications. Yeah. It's going to mess up how stakeholders look at that product. There's just too many. Like, you're building a brand with caveats.
Yeah.
And that's the last thing you want to do. So, anyway, you get the rest. So there needs to be a way for us to be able to differentiate.
Yeah. No, because the danger in going from three campaigns to one within the course of a year is that, you know, the brand's management team says, well, we're only going to do one. This one's got to count for 10 different audience profiles, you know, instead of us segmenting, when actually you really need to apply the reverse logic in that case.
That's right. I mean, like these bigger companies, to go to, you know, going back to that big company reference that I made earlier, you know, it's always, you know, this is the media team's KPI, this is the e-commerce team's KPI, this is the brand team's KPI, this is that team's KPI. And when you have a new product that needs to be launched and it needs to, you know, needs to serve the sales target, as in the consumer segment that you're targeting to sell the product versus the consumer segment that you're targeting to make aware of that product versus that audience that's prescribed or subscribing to your social footprint, a lot of times that's three sets of people, right? And then obviously the new NPD or the new product development kind of department has their own set of KPIs. And so when you go into these big organizations, you're kind of lost, you know, you're already on the back foot because you're trying to hit the expectations of so many different departments. And this great, wonderful product just gets lost in serving the needs of different stakeholders within the organization. Anyway, that's going into a tangent and that's a different discussion altogether. But I think that startup thinking would be very, very...
Yeah, that was the point I was going to make, Ali, was that That's so hard to do in a large organizations, because I don't know how many meetings I've been to where we with the marketing team, you know, agency and marketers hand in hand would present to the management of the company what we thought was the target audience, and this is where it is. And of course, it was always shot down to being, oh, that's too small. We won't hit our volume targets. We've got to go bigger. And then that we water it down. And then of course, we've just kind of lost the whole point of doing what you just said. Mm. And suddenly we're a boring mass brand again, because that's where we think that the volume of the business is coming from. Yeah. And if we become too laser focused, oh, we're going to miss out.
That's right. That's why they just end up acquiring new brands as opposed to creating them. I mean, like that whole thought around innovation, it's better for it to exist outside of an established organization than it to be built within or created within. I mean, sorry, I could go on for a long time, but accelerator programs within large organizations never work. And they don't work because, you know, like LVMH is a luxury brand, is a luxury company. It's not a, like, let me create innovative products, all right? Coca-Cola is a beverages company. It's not a, let me, you know, rethink thirst, right? Et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of companies that do that a lot better. So these bigger companies just end up acquiring them instead.
Yeah. The word that we use to challenge brand clients around, you know, marketing that makes impact is bravery, right? And are you acting with bravery? Right. And that's not always easy to do. Yeah. Well,
if you had to put a KPI on bravery, what would that be? Like, how do you KPI that?
I think the closest thing to that is gauging for how memorable something was, right? You know, because, you know, bravery can land in either side. I mean, you know, bravery can get you a lot of positive and negative sentiment all of the time, but you know, in the world of marketing, you know, being memorable counts for a lot, right?
For sure.
Just before we go to the famous A-B test, are we all ready for the A-B test, Ali?
差不多.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I have a few. Yeah. So, yeah, as I said in the early part of the show, the full 10 considerations, we just talked about 5 with Minnie and Chris today. The full 10 considerations is available to download. Just simply scroll down to the show notes and you'll see the links to both report and the considerations. So let's do it. Ali, A-B test.
Chris, starting with you, trends or observations?
Observations.
Okay. Minnie, premiumization or value creation?
Value creation.
Okay. Gen Z or Generation Silver Surfers?
Gen Z.
Trust or transparency?
Trust.
Product or influencer?
Product.
Show or tell?
Tell.
Always on or shopping festivals?
Always on.
Private traffic or word of mouth?
Word of mouth.
Impact or impressions?
Impact.
Startup or listed corporation with $100+ million valuation?
Startup.
That's ridiculous. I would go on for the corporation. Anyway, Minnie, Chris, thanks again for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Learn a lot from this show. And thank you, Bryce and Ali, for inviting me to join Shanghai Zhan as a long-time fan and listener to this show. Thank you so much, Chris. We've read your report. It's like over 100 pages this year. You must have invested lots of efforts on resources into deep research.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us on today's episode. Join us in a few weeks for another exciting show. And to all our listeners, until then, have a great day.